Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. First thing I think we ought to do is have introductions of members. I'll get the tall one to start just as soon as he sits down, okay? Senator Fisher?
Bill Fisher from District 1, formerly District 23, or at least portions of District 23. I was a state representative for two terms, and I'm in the last part of my second term as state senator. Been on the Ag and Natural Resources Committee in some form or another ever since I've been in the legislative process. Also chair the Health and Human Services Committee and have for four sessions in the Senate. I have a background being raised on a dryland wheat farm in eastern Washington. Worked there for years and years, and then my uncles and grandfather started a diversified farm in 1951 when the Columbia Basin Project opened up in Moses Lake, Washington. So I've basically raised everything from wheat to watermelons and sugar beets and the fertilizers, pesticides, whatever it took to get the job done, and sprinkler irrigation. And unfortunately, most of my experience was before they had air-conditioned tractor cabs and wheel moves and things like that, so most of mine was the physical learning of how things went on the farm. But I enjoyed and have a high regard for our natural resource industries. It bothers me no end when I see our opportunities locked up and the key thrown away, because I think that if we work together, we can solve our problems and still provide a very fine environment with lots of opportunities for people to provide good products for us to eat and to use in our manufacturing. And so those would be my goals, is to keep things reasonable and while we're working with conservation efforts to get the most we can out of our land and our environment, we're also not locking it up and throwing away the key and making it totally impossible for our natural resource-based industries to make a go of it.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. As did Senator Fisher, so will the rest of us not only introduce ourselves, but kind of say a little bit about what's important to us. Senator Corcoran, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Tony Corcoran. I'm from Senate District 4, which used to be Senate District 22. It has North Douglas County and South Lane County. It goes from University of Oregon campus down to about 10 miles north of Crater Lake, and from the McKenzie Pass over to Scottsburg. It's a very large district with a lot of trees. I'd like to see some of those trees cut down someday. I guess the only thing I would say, I've served on Ag and Natural Resources in the House. I have not in the Senate. Actually, I think I did maybe my first term in the Senate. And I'd echo Senator Fisher. I just think we need to keep it reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Roger Beyer, Senate District 9, which used to go from the Coast Range to the Cascades. Now it goes down the Cascades from Wilsonville to almost Eugene, down to Senator Corcoran's district in Lane County. Again, like Senator Corcoran's and Senator Fisher's, lots of trees with not very many people in between them, and we need to cut those trees down. I couldn't agree more. Tree farmer.
We're off to a good start here.
Tree farmer from Moala.
You cut them down when they're real little, though.
Oh, yeah, I try. I kill my share every year.
That's what Senator Wyden wanted. He wanted to cut more newer trees.
Well, I'm Senator Shields, and there aren't a lot of trees in my district except in the city parks. And I've been teased already about how's a city boy end up chairing an Ag and Natural Resources Committee, so I'll tell you a little bit about me. I grew up on a little farm in western Pennsylvania where we not only farmed above the ground, but my father had a small coal mine underneath the ground, so we got the natural resources from both above and below the surface. And I started digging coal in that coal mine when I was about 11 years old for fun. I liked it down there. It was an interesting job. Besides, you could make more money digging coal than I could any other after-school job when I was a kid. When I moved to Oregon, as a Methodist minister back in the 70s, my first assignment was in Chiloquin and Fort Klamath, and I spent several years down there, and a lot of my parishioners were the ranchers and the loggers of the Wainema National Forest and the great wide open spaces. I had ranchers with 10,000 acre ranches down there, so it was an interesting experience. As far as the agenda of the committee, it'll become apparent to people in the next 4 or 5 days. I'm going to do an overview from a lot of the different agencies and so on. And I'm announcing this now, and I'll announce it every time from now until the end of next week. I'm going to give you an invitation to provide comments on any of the stuff that you hear from the various agencies that make presentations, and we're going to do that on Friday, January 31st. So if you represent a particular interest group and you'd like to have some time before the committee just to comment on things in general, please see Judith and get your name on the list, and that way we'll know what we're heading into on Friday the 31st, a little bit ahead of time. Anyway, the reason I do that is because I just want to run a fair committee that listens to everybody and takes in all points of view. I know that we'll have some interesting stuff before us before we're through. It's becoming more and more apparent every day as the list of people stopping by my office gets longer and longer. And I do that just to introduce myself as one that would like to see a fair, open process run, and I want to do what I can to keep the committee moving. I suggested that we not start our work until 8:30, until our workload gets a little bit easier. Why fight the 8 o'clock rush hour if we can avoid it around the Capitol? So that's my suggestion for the moment. I also want to have introductions of the staff, and I'm going to ask Judith if she'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members and guests. For the few of you who don't know me, my name is Judith Callens. I have served the Oregon Legislature since 1995 as a committee administrator for various natural resources committees, both during the interim and during the sessions. This will be my fourth session coming up. Prior to moving to Oregon, I worked for the Governor's State Water Plan Advisory Council in Montana, developing sections of their state water plan. And prior to that, I served the Wisconsin legislature doing both fiscal and policy analysis. I hold two master's degrees, one in public policy analysis and a master's of science in natural resources management. And recently, I had the honor of being appointed by the National Conference of State Legislatures, first serving as their staff vice chair and then the staff chair of their Science, Energy, and Environmental Resources Committee. That term ended last year. But that was a great benefit to me because I did meet a lot of folks in other states at the federal level as well as NCSL staff that deal with all of these sorts of issues, and that allows me to share that information with the membership here. And so this session, I'm very much looking forward to serving you as your committee administrator. I'd like to introduce our committee assistants. Standing is Patricia Nielsen. She has been here. She worked last session as well and has been here ever since. Megan's new to our team, and we will be working to make sure that you have everything that you need to accomplish what you want this session. I will be visiting each of your offices to leave off cards so that if you have any constituent questions come up that you need assistance with, any research needs, or certainly any help with the process or any background on bills coming forward, please, please don't hesitate to contact me, and we will assist you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. You realize that Judith is quite a resource to the Natural Resources Committee. In fact,
it's the first of many bad puns that we'll hear all session. All session. Just get used to it. Oh, God. That's why God invented guns. I swear to God. This is going to be a bad one.
Sometimes the senator to my extreme left has a hard time containing himself, but I just ask your dispensation in his behalf. I did want to say seriously that Judith has such a range of abilities and brings so much knowledge to the committee that Senator Farioli and I agreed not to fight over her, and we are going to share her between our two committees. He bluntly said I could have half of her, but he'd fight me to the death if I tried to get her totally on my committee. So she's staffing also the Land Use and Water Committee. I want to emphasize that since we are four in number, if you are going to be absent, please let Judith know. Because with two of you, we don't have a quorum, okay? So if you're not going to be here, please let Judith know a day or so ahead of time, and we'll try to adjust. I'm going to ask Judith if she'll review the committee rules for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you have a set of the rules at your desk. You received one in your office, but you also had one at your seat. These are the model committee rules that you've probably seen in other committees. I'll just point out a few things. Our quorum, as the chair said, is three members, so we need at least three of you in the room whenever we're taking any sort of action. It has the open meetings and public meetings language in there. The meetings can be recessed or adjourned by either the chair or a vote of the majority of the members present. The chair has the prerogative to appoint subcommittees. You'll note an affirmative vote of the majority of the committee is required for measures to be introduced, to table a measure, to remove a measure from the table, to amend a measure, or to send a measure to the floor. I wanted to point out just a few more things. Upon written request of a majority of the committee members, the chair shall order a hearing or work session on any measure in possession of the committee. I also wanted to point out in the instance of minority reports must be, you must notify the chair or myself by 5 p.m. of that session day or by the adjournment of the meeting if it goes beyond 5 o'clock. And you will note that normally a minority report does require a second member to sign on. And this is one point I wanted to explain. If three members are voting to get a measure out of committee and the dissenting member would like to file a minority report, the Senate president can sign on, but he does have to be in the room when the vote is taken for him to sign on to a minority report. So just be aware that if you think that might be a possibility, we'll work out, we'll invite him and ask him, it is his prerogative to come to the meeting and join in on that vote if he so chooses. So I wanted to just let you be aware of that situation. Proposed amendments by other than members of the Legislative Assembly, any of you folks, please get any proposed amendments that you have drafted and you want the committee to address. Certainly, I assume you will talk to the chair about that, but I need to have that amendment 48 hours in advance of the work session so I can get the fiscal and revenue estimates, that sort of thing. The chair certainly may waive that requirement. And finally, the last point of the rules is just a reminder that they would like us to see LC-drafted amendments before we passed any amended bill out of committee. And that's where we're at with the rules, Mr. Chair.
And do you have any questions about the rules?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On a minority report, does the president then have to also enter into the vote and register a no vote in order to be on the minority report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher, that is correct. He would have to be in the room present, and then he could choose to cast that vote to sign on to the minority report. He would indeed need to do that, yes.
Sure. I'll take a motion now.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the rules as presented.
Is there any dissent?
I've got to do it for consistency. Rule number 9, I don't believe, reflects that what the practice of the Senate committees will be this session. The rule says that the committee shall be recorded and shall be transcribed to give a true reflection of the matters discussed. And my understanding is that just so the public knows, that the staff will not be transcribing the that have been giving a true reflection in their written minutes. They will only work, from my understanding, what they get done during the meeting. So if you want to get a true reflection of what was said, you have to go listen to it on the internet or via tape, which is our available. So I'd like to just point that out, that rule does not actually reflect our practice.
That's right, and it is a staffing issue. We literally don't have the money, as you all know, have people literally transcribing every word said. But the really helpful thing I find here is the way there's kind of an outline being made so that you can easily find in a tape where the important section that you want to listen to would be found because of the outline that the staff is making of the meeting as we proceed. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it a lot easier for you to find something if you wanted to in the record.
We will be so entertaining to people who want to listen to the entire committee meeting on tape or internet, I would think, over and over again.
Right. Yeah,
you
right.
Your medication.
any objection to the
if
rules?
If I don't like these rules, I've got to get the president down here and vote no on it and get him an argument for it.
It's like the old Groucho Marx line, you know, I got these principles, and if you don't like them, I got some more over here.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The committee rules are adopted.
And
what I'm doing now is opening the informational meeting, and I'd like to call up Jim Brown at this point. I want to welcome you to our committee this morning. It's good to have
Jim Brown multiplied.
Yeah, it looks like there's three guys named Jim Brown here. Would you like to start by introducing yourself and your team?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Brown. I've been recently appointed as the governor's natural resource policy director, and I have with me Dave Vantoff on my right and Jim Myron on my left, who are working with me as part of the natural resource team for the governor. I've had about a 36-year career with the Oregon Department of Forestry, last almost 17 years as the director of that agency. Jim Myron spent about 30 years in the insurance industry, retired, and then became a volunteer for Oregon Trout, and then later became a paid staff member for them before moving to this position. And Dave had worked as a clerk in the Supreme Court for Justices Gillespie and Kulongoski, and then went to work for Stoll Reeves as an attorney in the natural resource field. So I think we've got a really well-balanced group of folks here that will be advising the governor and working with you as you work through the session. You had asked that I visit with you a little bit this morning about, if you will, the governor's natural resource agenda. What I'm going to share with you is really what I have combed from the speeches that he has given, plus some personal conversation that I've had. But please understand, we're still learning and have a lot to learn as we kind of step into this position. I think you saw through the inaugural address, as well as through the speech he gave at the Oregon Economic Summit in Portland on the 9th of December, that his goal is to get the economy back on track in order, in turn, to provide Oregonians with a high quality of life. And I mean by that having a job, being able to educate their children, public safety, human resource services, and as well as a quality environment. And I think the thing that attracted me to this job was his interest in, much like you said in your opening comments, it's the economy and the environment. It's not the economy or the environment. And I think it's that and construction that really interested me in this. He's also, through his inaugural address, wants government to be a partner, not a roadblock, and that to rebuild our economy that by creating new job opportunities for Oregon families, and that on the rural parts of the state, ag and forestry is a key. And that within the framework of government being a partner with business, it'll be along the lines of easier to get a permit, with recognizing that the agencies giving the permits by statute have to do due diligence in granting those permits, holding the agencies accountable for their performance, and increase the availability of industrial lands without changing Oregon's long tradition of protecting our environmental factors for future generations. I think he's also interested from the regulatory streamlining standpoint of how the attitude of agencies and how they approach their business and working with their customers. And that the branding of products, such as a brand Oregon for agricultural products or forest products, is an interesting opportunity. So I think the themes that you're probably going to see as we move along are implementing the regulatory streamlining report. That was a committee that I chaired during the interim for, at that time, the DAS director, Mike Greenfield, and that was partly in response to some work that you were doing. And that report reflected that it's a shared responsibility in terms of regulatory streamlining. That is, the agencies have a role, the governor has a leadership role, the legislature may have a role in helping streamline statutes where an agency may be living with some old statutes that could be cobbled, and we need to kind of harmonize those. Local government certainly has a role. Oregon has delegated a lot of our responsibilities to local government, and they have a role in streamlining. And then I think business and the individuals that are applying for permits also have a role. That is, as they're starting their due diligence in starting a project that they want, the earlier that they can let state government or government know that they're starting, and it's easier for them for government then to start its due diligence in granting the permit. So it's a shared responsibility for that. I think land use obviously is going to be a topic as we talk about how do we provide buildable space in order to attract business. I already mentioned the product branding and the marketing that we think EDD will be working on. I think a big piece in the natural resource area will be the intersection with the federal government. And it's going to be in a couple different areas. One is trying to get ESA, Endangered Species Act, assurances for people that are complying with the Oregon Plan. I think the water issues in Klamath Basin are another example of trying to get ESA assurances so that people can go about their business in an orderly way. And then I think the federal land management issues, as the Bush administration tries to implement the Northwest Forest Plan, but untangle itself from some of the procedural nightmares that have been created over time. Obviously, I think the state of Oregon is going to want to play a role in that. As I look out into the future, I think long term, over the next 20 years, the state is going to have to deal with water supply as we have another million people added to the state. Coupled with that would be energy. And then I think one that some of you have heard me talk about when I wore my hat as the state forester, that over the years we have built a matrix of laws of environmental protection, and that we need to probably step back and kind of look at the sum of what we have. The term I've used to describe that is a conservation strategy for the state. That is, what is it we're trying to accomplish, and where's the line between what the landowner is expected to provide and what the public is going to have to pay for? I mean, it kind of gets to the heart of the takings issue that I know is of concern to many. But I think if you're going to get at the takings issue, there has to be some comprehensive understanding of what it is we're trying to attain and what's that role of responsibility between the landowner and the public. I think snow removal and 404 assumption will be issues that we'll probably both be dealing with, as well as the mine reclamation. And you'll see that in some of the bills that the agencies have submitted. As I've reviewed the bill packages that the different agencies have submitted, I would characterize them as trying a couple things. One is to clarify or streamline the policies that you have already established, but make them more workable, both for the agencies as well as for the clientele that these agencies are working with. And then funding bills that will help pay for the programs that these customers want. And obviously, budgets within the budget balance theme that you've heard the governor articulate will be a key piece of business. Now, one of the things that I'm going to be asking each of the natural resource agencies to do is to use the model that the Oregon Business Council used when they had the economic summit in Portland that many people, including the governor, participated in. And that would be to have each of the agencies write an economic action plan that lines out what their, if you will, barriers are and what their opportunities are within the framework of jobs and the environment. And out of that, I hope to be able to then crystallize a recommended agenda for the governor, and at the point we have that, we'd be happy to come back and share that with you. But I think, Mr. Chair, at that point, I'll stop and answer whatever questions you or the committee might have.
Just a quick question. You talked about this economic action plan. What's your timeline on that?
I'm going to have probably the middle to the end of February. It's going to take the agencies 2 or 3 weeks to write it, and then I want us to be able to sit down internally and synthesize that and kind of cook up, when I say cook, to distill those pieces that obviously lie within the purview of the agency, and what are those issues that the governor's office can help facilitate. Now, you'll notice that this staff of this office is much smaller than the previous administration. That was by design. And part of my philosophy is that the work ought to be done within the agency, and that the role of the governor's office is kind of facilitation coordination.
Questions? I did have one question. You made reference to the takings issue earlier, and I've reflected on this, as everybody else has, I'm sure. And I've often wondered, you know, how the problem was created, in the sense that if some folks at local and state government levels both weren't quite so heavy-handed or so arrogant, if that might have been mitigated without resulting in ballot measures and everything else. What's your perspective on that?
Mr. Chair, I think it's probably a mix of several things. I think that's an element, but let me give you a specific example that I've dealt with in my former chair. There's an individual that lives in Lincoln County that owns about 3,000 acres of forest land. Had some spotted owls, which are a federally listed endangered species, on her property. Went through a very expensive land exchange with the U.S. Forest Service and basically traded away the pieces of property that had owls on it, and spent about $60,000 doing a biological assessment, got back a cool, clean piece of property, only to discover that it had a bald eagle nest site on it. Under the Forest Practices Act, that meant she had to protect about not only the nest tree, but about 10 acres around it in order to provide the wind firmness necessary, because it's also an endangered species. This is older timber. My guess is the value of that timber is probably a couple $100,000. Yet I, under the Forest Practices Act, have no way to provide her any regulatory relief. So I think that at some point, this is my own personal philosophy now, I don't know where the governor is on this, but I think at some point the state has to define what is undue burden. I mean, I would approach it rather than takings, where does undue burden occur? And that's because if you take it from the taking standpoint under the federal constitution, I mean, you end up with nearly all the property of a landowner can be impacted and still not have a take. So I think it's in the state's interest to think about where does undue burden occur. And it is probably a combination of what the regulatory baseline requires and what a landowner might be willing to do at a landscape scale on a voluntary basis, such as the Oregon Plan. How you weave that together, I've done a lot of thinking on this. I've got some ideas, but it's a tricky line between what our regulatory baselines ought to be, and then at what point does undue burden occur. And I think it's kind of that combination plus how we've approached it. And that's why I've personally have advanced the idea of the state needing some sort of a conservation strategy so we can think in the large about what it is we're trying to accomplish. Now, that threatens some people because they see that as another regulatory overlay. I tend to come at it more from an analytic standpoint of let's have a conversation about what we're trying to accomplish in this state and who then has what responsibility, rather than right now it's all kind of dumped on the back of the landowner.
Thank you. I do have one other question, but I'm wanting to be fair and let anybody else ask questions too if they want, recognizing that we're going to keep moving if not. Go ahead.
Just a comment. I get a little leery because when you talk about projecting when you'll have information and so forth, I can't help but go back to Bruce Babbitt's comment about when he was asked here in 1993, along in March, when we'd have timber in the pipeline. And he said October.
Yep.
And here it is almost 10 years later, timber in the pipeline. So,
yep.
I have a lot more faith in what you're going to do by now in February.
Well,
we've heard in the past.
Senator Fisher, you could be right. It may take me a little longer to go through. It depends on how it kind of sifts out and what conversations I'm able to have with the governor as we try to synthesize that. But, I mean, that we have to do this fairly quickly, I think, in order for us to, in turn, to be able to provide advice to the agencies.
Senator Fisher, I do want to point out that your colleague, Senator Beyer, understood Mr. Babbitt. He said October. He just didn't say which year.
Unfortunately, he did.
Did he? Okay. Quick question. You talked about water supply and energy as we get, quote, unquote, a million more people in the state. I'm often kind of taken back by this automatic assumption of growth in Oregon, and I'm aware that there's a lot of people that wish that people would come and visit and not stay, and we weren't growing quite so fast, all of that. How much thinking will your office or the governor be doing about that kind of growth and what to expect? I don't even know the timeline. I missed how fast you said we were going to get this million.
Well, the projections are that the state will have another million in the next 20 years. And that's really a function of the Department of Water Resources under the statutes. I mean, you've charged them with worrying about that subject. And I know that Paul Cleary is thinking about that. But I think at some point as a state, we're gonna have to address that issue.
Is there a geographical breakdown, or have they thought enough about that? Does that mean mostly in the Willamette Valley?
I think the projection. I think most of the projections have demonstrated that most of those people are going to be coming into the Willamette Valley, probably the Medford Valley.
Farmers here love that. Well, thank you very much. Any other questions? Well, let's move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
for coming by.
According to light rail, 700,000 of those were going to be in your district.
Thanks a lot. That means there's going to need to be about six more of me then up there.
That's a scary thing.
We can use the prayers.
Thank you for your points of view, gentlemen.
Just trying to be helpful, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm here to serve.
Uh-huh. We'll comment on that later. I'd like to invite Lindsey Ball up. He's going to share with us an overview of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. This is just the first of about eight different overviews that I've that we're asking for. Welcome. Thank you for coming to our committee this morning.
Well, thank you for the invitation today, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And today I come before you to give you a brief on the agency's statutory authority, legislative concepts, and a couple of other topics of interest that I think will be a subject of discussion in legislature this session. The ORS chapters 496 through 513 are the chapters that give the agency of the Department of Fish and Wildlife the authority, responsibility, and purpose. And in 496.012, which is our wildlife policy for the state of Oregon, it directs the agency to manage and or prevent serious depletion of any indigenous species and to provide optimum recreational and aesthetic benefits for present and future generations of the state. That kind of gives you a bit of an idea how legislature has provided direction to the department. And probably for this session, of course, is with many state agencies, a budget issue is of vital concern to the agency. And this legislative session, we are proposing a fee increase under House Bill 2260 to maintain current service levels that the Department of Fish and Wildlife provides today. There are no enhancements in this fee package. This is just to maintain status quo in the department. Give you a little bit of an idea of the process that we went through in proposing this fee increase. The first thing that we did from the director's office is we gathered, invited about 25 people to be a budget advisory committee to the director's office of ODFW and the commission. And from that committee, we started then on a series of town hall meetings. And I really wanted to get public input with respect to this budget. And I'm quite a fan on town hall meetings. I like being out and talking to the people, finding out what they think. I think we got some pretty good direction from the public that came to our town hall meetings and the people who corresponded with us through phone calls, letters, and emails as well. And there's four things that we learned that the public who came to the meetings and sent correspondence to us, they're very adamant about. Because when we posed our budget situation to the public, we said, number one, we're going to balance the budget in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We're not going to experience what we've had seen in the past. And so it either means we cut services or we raise fees. Well, the services that they didn't want cut, and they made it very clear, was that they didn't want to see field staff, field biologists cut from the department. They didn't want to see cuts to Fish and Wildlife Enforcement and State Police. They did not want to see any hatcheries cut, for the most part. And for the most part, there's a few people who would disagree with this, but I'm talking about the wide majority of the people. And also, the hunters and anglers of the state did not want to see assistance programs to landowners cut, which is really kind of heartening to me because it sent a clear message that the hunter and angler recognize the contribution of private landowners to fish and wildlife in the state, and that they wanted to provide them assistance where they could. Specifically about the fee increase, if you'll note, for the most part, on hunting licenses and tags, and angling licenses and associated tags, it's a $5 increase. The External Budget Advisory Committee and the public felt that that was appropriate, supported that. But they did advise us that we should take the percentage increase of resident licenses and then increase non-resident licenses that same percentage point. So you'll see that the non-resident licenses increased by much more than $5, but it is a percentage increase commensurate with what you see with resident licenses. Another bill that we have is a legislative concept. House Bill 2558 repeals the sunset on hunting license surcharges. Each hunting license that is sold has a $2 surcharge. That money goes to the Access and Habitat Board that was created in 1993 by legislature. That money is used for habitat enhancements on primarily private lands, also access to private lands by hunters. And as an example, in the biennium of 99-2001, the Access and Habitat Board surcharge opened up 3,756,667 acres of private land to the public for hunting. As another example of what the Access and Habitat Board has done, this last year when we had so many wildland fires throughout the state, the Access and Habitat Board saw the opportunity to assist private landowners once again and spent $132,446 for seed that could be used on private lands, and they reseeded 7,829 acres of private land with those funds. It's been a well-accepted program, and we received direction from the commission at our December meeting that we ask that that sunset be lifted permanently and that program become an institution in the state. House Bill 2259 extends a sunset an additional 6 years on our Restoration and Enhancement Board. Restoration and Enhancement Board was created back in 1989. There's a $2 surcharge on angling licenses. There is some money that comes from commercial fishing licenses and poundage fees as well into that account. The money is used for such things as hatchery maintenance, operation of fish liberation trucks, equipment at hatcheries, fishways and fish screens, and also angler access and some habitat projects as well. As an example, during this biennium, 2001-2003, the R&E funds have provided approximately $1.7 million for hatchery maintenance, $818,000 for hatchery propagation, $150,000 for restoration and monitoring efforts, $72,000 for fish passage activities. And as an example of the enhancement side of that, oftentimes we can go to a private landowner, enter into an agreement with him to allow anglers to access his property with use of a boat ramp or foot traffic, and it opens up lands for the angler that would otherwise be closed, and an opportunity to drift a section of river that would otherwise be closed. Another bill that we're proposing before legislature is House Bill 2209, which allows us to take game animals from an airplane. This came about a bit to our surprise as a result of a tuberculosis outbreak in a cervid ranch in central Oregon. And there was a good chance that that disease had escaped the impoundment at the cervid ranch and had gotten into the wild population. Further analysis with the Department of Ag identified that as bovine tuberculosis, which if it had gotten into the livestock industry, it may have threatened the TB-free status that Oregon now enjoys. With the use of taking animals that are potentially diseased, with the use of an aircraft, we may be able to contain a disease in the future. If an outbreak should occur, I think it's an extremely important provision in the law that would allow us that tool. It could also get to the point where it may be a public safety hazard, health hazard as well, that we could address in this manner.
That's true.
Yes.
So, Lindsay, I just wanted to be clear. What was the origin of the tuberculosis? You said in the cervid population that would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, what occurred was in a licensed servage facility in Central Oregon, at an elk ranch, an elk died, and that elk, upon examination, was determined to have bovine tuberculosis. The animal was actually removed from the enclosure and taken to a site away and left to be scavenged by animals and such, which would have been an easy vector for that disease to get into the wild population, as well as possibly the livestock in that surrounding area as well.
So we probably won't be seeing much legislation on game farms this session, eh?
Senator Shields, Senator Corcoran, I couldn't speculate on that.
I was kidding. I didn't expect an answer.
But at any rate, this provision in the law would allow us a tool that we presently don't have that I think is necessary for the fish and wildlife management programs we have and the livestock industry. And as I said, it could trickle into some public health issues as well. We have a bit of a house cleaning a bill before legislature. It's LC 635/5. Simply what it does is updates our statutes and removes authority requiring the Department of Fish and Wildlife to issue permits and such on harmful substances in our waters. That is currently handled by the Department of Environmental Quality. This law was passed prior to DEQ being created, and DEQ does all that work today. We don't. We just simply need to place the authority in DEQ where it belongs and not with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so it's just a matter of keeping up with the times and cleaning up a statute that needs to be taken care of.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How many of those permits do you get annually or biannually?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, no one can remember when we wrote a permit. And it's all done by DEQ, and my way of thinking, we just will clean that thing up and leave it in DEQ where it's being done now.
So, Mr. Chair, you're not technically following the law and issuing the extra permit because you indicated here it gets rid of a duplicate permit requirement.
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, that authority is extended to DEQ with their specific authority, and we haven't been issuing any of those permits. A couple of additional issues I'd like to bring to your attention. A couple of things that we've been working on this last year. One is a creation of a Oregon Salmon Hatchery Research Center. And when I mention that, everyone thinks money. Please don't panic on me. Let me explain what we want to accomplish. The Hatchery Research Center that we're proposing would be sited at Fall Creek Hatchery, which is currently mothballed. If you'll recall, Fall Creek Hatchery was the site of the infamous fish clubbing. That hatchery's been shut down since that time. We have a water right, we have the land, we have the facility. What we don't have in this state is a research center on fishery management related issues. Oregon is behind the times. We were a leader in the 60s and 70s in fish aquaculture. We are not anymore. Idaho, Washington, British Columbia, California have such research centers, and other countries have research centers as well. We do not. And what we do have is an opportunity with a facility that already exists, which is a cost savings. We also have an account set up in the Department of Fish and Wildlife that has $1.8 million sitting in it. Now, we received that money about a year ago and have held on to that money, have not spent it. And that money came from Portland General Electric as mitigation for fish loss at the Sullivan Generating Plant at Willamette Falls. In 1971, the department and PGE reached an agreement that PGE would pay the department for fish lost at that generating plant. For 30 years, no one did anything with that agreement. We pulled it out, dusted it off, and said we need to tend to business here, and PGE certainly was agreeable to that. And over the years, we calculated that the value of the fish that lost at that plant came to $1.8 million. One of the things that we did accomplish in the agreement is that that money would be held in the Department of Fish and Wildlife in a separate account and would have oversight by legislature as to how it would be spent. Normally, fish lost in a main stem or tributary, that money goes back into that specific tributary or main stem. So we have the latitude to move those dollars around a little bit. But once again, it's going to be done with the oversight of legislature. We did make sure that legislature through eBoard knew we had that money. That money was not utilized through the five special sessions that we had, and it's still sitting untouched in a separate account. We're proposing that that money could be used to pay part of the $7 million tab to create such a research facility in Oregon. And we're looking at other... we are looking at other sources for funding. And I also need to mention in closing on that topic that this would be a partnership with Oregon State University. If we can have students working in a research lab such as this, graduating from that school, I can hire those people into this agency. I'll get the best and the brightest, the latest research knowledge and technology for how we raise fish in Oregon. I think it's going to be a win-win for everyone if we can put all the things together that need to be done. And bottom line is, you know, we hear a lot of this debate over hatchery wild fish. I think our native fish conservation policy that we passed this last November in front of the commission has dissolved a lot of that debate. We're going to have hatcheries, and I think if we invest in research, it will just simply perfect our fishery management practices. Another topic that I'm sure you're going to hear about is the wolf issue that we're starting to deal with in Oregon. Idaho has wolves, and wolves are migrating from Idaho into Oregon. First one that entered Oregon from Idaho was documented in 1999. There's going to be more. There'll probably be 100 plus pups born this next spring in that area of Idaho where the wolves inhabit, in that Salmon River country. They're going to move out of that wilderness area into Oregon, just like kids at home. Once they get a little older, they move out. And Oregon doesn't have a... Beg your pardon?
If you're lucky.
Well, maybe we're unlucky then. But those wolves are moving out of Idaho. They're going to come to Oregon. They're a very social animal. They detect and live by a pack, and they detect where packs are. We don't have one established in Oregon that we know of yet, but I'm sure... wolves in Idaho know that, and they will be here. The question I challenge the commission with, and I think it's very important that this is noted, and that's why it's important that this legislature takes note of this as well. My question of the commission was, do we have the appropriate laws in place today to deal with wolves coming to Oregon? And the commission, after much discussion, decided that we should hold public hearings in front of the commission to inform the commission. And then I suggested that we once again hold some town hall meetings to find out what Oregon thinks about the wolf, but also to make sure that the Oregonians knew that the wolf is coming. Wolves strike the emotion of many, many people. Of course, the ag industry is very concerned about the impact that wolves will have on livestock as we use public and private lands throughout Oregon for grazing. And I'd be the first one to tell you that wolves eat meat. And they also eat not just livestock, but they eat wildlife. And so that's created quite an interest on behalf of hunters in Oregon as well. And then we have people who feel that wolves deserve to be in Oregon and should be part of the ecosystem. The other thing I've noted, not just about the issue about whether or not we have the right laws, but in watching how other states have dealt with the wolf issue, I've watched them work independently from the legislature. I've seen the legislature ban state agencies from dealing with the wolf, and I really don't feel that that has been in their best interest. In evaluating how other states have done it, I feel it needs to be a coordinated effort between the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission and the legislature, not one opposed to the other, but both working together in a partnership. Now, you have authority over statutes, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife has authority over administrative rules. I think between the two of us, we can come up with an appropriate set of laws that will provide the best service for people of Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, Lindsay, will you be providing some examples of the existent law in other states to give us some guidance on this, or even some of the administrative rules that have been developed to kind of get a handle on this?
Chair Shields, Senator Corcoran, yes, we can accomplish that task. The two things that were most troublesome to me when I brought this to the attention of our commission, one was earlier in the previous administration, the chair of the commission and the director had signed a letter stating that the policy of the department would be to remove all wolves from Oregon. Well, I must say that was inappropriate, because we have a state statute that says we should manage the wolf because it is an endangered species. And so the Endangered Species Act quickly came to bear an issue that we need to resolve internally in the department. And then the second thing that I challenged the commission on was whether or not the law that would prohibit a landowner from shooting a wolf that was killing his or her livestock would then be in violation of law. Is that an appropriate statute? And those two things I think we need to discuss and have a public forum on and come to a decision. Then everyone, of course, is talking about wolf management plans, and I haven't gotten that far. I want to make sure we have the correct foundation of law on the books, and then from that law, we take the next step if necessary. That's a policy issue that would have to be driven by the commission and the legislature. As director, I've identified a couple of issues that I think need to be addressed, and that basis is on law. And I've also got to make sure that you're aware that we've already identified in the state of Oregon, if you place a wolf in Oregon, there's going to be conflict. There's no place in Oregon where the range of a wolf won't cross paths with someone or someone's property. It's going to happen. And with those knowing that the wolves are coming from Idaho, knowing the conflict, knowing our current status of the law, I felt necessary to bring this subject forward and have the discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, you remind me of the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. As you know, I talked with you before when the aftermath of the Roseburg Wolf meeting about my concern about budget problems and money being spent running around the state finding out something. Basically, we knew that any environmentalist basically is going to want to have wolves, and any rancher pretty much is not going to want to have wolves. and a lot of the rest of us are of that same opinion that we've been getting along very well without them. Have you initiated any efforts, or is the commission considering any possibilities of expending some money instead of running around the state finding out what we already know, to going back to Washington, D.C. and start telling them back there that if these wolves cross over here and they're going to assume that they're offspring of their experimental tribe and they're going to treat them that way, that we demand the right to have the right to defend our livestock by dispatching them if they're causing problems, and if we pass this airplane hunting bill that you've got here, that's an excellent way of dispatching errant wolves and giving us the same rights that they've given to violate the ESA Endangered Species Act to the experimental group in Idaho. Because if we're going to have to be a foster parent to this incoming horde, we ought to have the same opportunities to deal with it that they're giving somebody else. And I, as I mentioned to you, I was decidedly disappointed that we weren't taking that step initially to get our foot in on the ground floor of it and so forth. Are there going to be attempts to do that? And can we hurry that along with some type of a bill recommending that to the federal government or something like that here in the legislature?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, there were several points that I'll try to pick up on them, and you help me if I miss some of them.
I didn't take enough notes, I don't think.
Number one, have we gone back to Washington to lobby the Fish and Wildlife Service or a congressional delegation on the matter? No, we have not. Washington came to me. And Director Steve Williams of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came out and spent 3 days with myself as well as the director from Idaho. And we've talked extensively about the wolf issue, among other things as well. Now, the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to release their plans for wolf management in the United States. Last October, Director Williams told me he would release that sometime in January. We've been told last week that it will probably come out sometime in the first week of February. Specific language in that plan, I can't tell you what it is. I raised all the same concerns that you raised with him, and I think I gave him a very balanced opinion of both the environmental side and landowning ranchers who object to wolves' presence in Oregon. And depending on what they then put in the plan, we'll see how good my work was. I feel very encouraged about some of the comments and the opportunity that I had to meet with Steve Williams. I think he's a pretty understanding individual. But I have yet to see what is in their proposal, too.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Did he offer any help with the funding of this project, of this, the animals that they're going to probably be sending our direction?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, he did not have any funding available for anything for Oregon at the time that he and I discussed that issue in October. Camper McMaster, the state supervisor for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for Oregon, has advised us that he would treat a wolf that is preying on livestock the same as they do in Montana or Idaho or Wyoming, and that is to remove those animals that are the offenders. But other than that, if they're not doing anything in Oregon, they're probably going to stay.
Other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, given that we've seen wolves at the door in the context of the Human Service budget for several years now, I was thinking that the committee should probably draft up language, given the conflict that's going to obviously occur with livestock and wolves, and maybe just suggesting that we just reintroduce them directly to Portland, because there's not much livestock there. Just trying to help you out in your district, Mr.
Thank Chair. You very much.
Okay.
Senator Corcoran, you know where I always turn for bright ideas in my caucus.
Just trying to be helpful.
Senator Fisher.
To get back to this idea of increasing the fees on hunting licenses, do you have any information that correlates how many hunters also buy fishing licenses? Because you've got a total here of 993,304 people that buy fishing licenses and hunting licenses. By the figures that you list, how many of those are the same individual? In other words, how many total people do we have buying these? You have 500,000 people or 300,000 people that buy hunting licenses all buy fishing licenses too, so that we can reduce that total number by that much?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, I don't have that information off the top of my head, but I've got that information back at the office. It's a simple task for us to look at, simply looking at the people who buy resident combination licenses will get you real close to the people who both hunt and fish in Oregon.
The reason I ask that, you've got approximately $14.7 million coming off the backs of those people as a direct tax with the $2 increases, and I'm guessing that the $2 surcharge is over and above what you've listed here as the actual fee. Is that correct?
In other words, Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, I'm not following you on the numbers.
Well, your resident combination license for license tag is $28 current fee, $38 proposed fee, a $10 increase. Then there would be a $2 surcharge if the sunset's taken off on top of that, so it would actually be $40. Is that right?
Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, if it was a resident combination license, the surcharge of $2...
Or $4 it would be $4, wouldn't it?
That's correct.
So it would be $42, right?
That is correct.
And that's why I'm saying your 10.3 there plus the amount that the fishing surcharge comes to and the amount that the hunting surcharge comes to is $14.7 million. Yeah, and let's say that we had two-fifths of the hunters or half the hunters bought fishing license. We're reducing to about 700,000 the actual amount of people that buy a hunting and fishing licenses. So we're putting a $14.7 million charge on the back of about 700,000 people. And that's a whale of a lot, any way you look at it.
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, the surcharge on the access and habitat as well as the restoration enhancement is already being paid by the angler. And the hunter.
But you would continue that and
yes.
Take the sunset off, which ultimately results in the same thing as adding it, even though they're now paying it. But what I'm trying to get across to you is that is one huge amount of money to take out of 700,000 people, any way you look at it. And they're not the only ones enjoying all of this thing. Matter of fact, there's a good many hunters and fishermen that get absolutely nothing more out of the hunting trip than somebody would hiking through the territory, because they're not even seeing a lot of game in certain instances, and certainly not coming home with any trophies or anything for the larder. And I guess I object to putting this all on the back of the hunter and the fisherman when other people are allowed to just drive through or walk through or do anything they want to and benefit from that by that. But to me, to take 700,000 people and take $14.7 million right out of their hide is a pretty stiff tax.
Well, I think Chair Shields and Senator Fisher, I think the next topic I want to bring to everyone's attention might further reinforce your thoughts on that subject.
Thank you, Lindsay. I think it's a good idea that you finish the report, and we'll hold our questions until you finish that piece.
In 2001, this is data for 2001, please understand, hunters in Oregon spent $481.8 million $481.8 million in the state of Oregon. And this comes to us by way of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service survey. That generated in the state of Oregon $15.7 million of general fund tax. It also generated $31.8 million of federal tax. Anglers in Oregon in 2001 spent $733.4 million in the state of Oregon, generating $23.3 million of state general fund tax. That also equated to $46.1 million of federal income tax. Now, the total that hunters and anglers spent in Oregon is $1.2 billion, generating a total of $39 million of general tax in the state of Oregon. So I guess Chair Shields and Senator Fisher, hunters and anglers in their pursuit of their recreation do create an economy in the state of Oregon. And that economy does generate $39 million to the state in general fund tax. And currently the state only invests $18 million of general fund in the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Is that 18?
That's correct. So that gives maybe a issue of balance that you might consider.
Well, I'm not denying that, Mr. Chair. I understand all of that, but this is a direct charge of an additional $14.7 million. And that's on top of the back of these people. And I'm talking about the guy that comes to me and says, I'm a disabled veteran. I can't afford to be paying $45, $50 for a hunting license anymore. I can't go hunting anymore.
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, the disabled veteran wouldn't pay that much. He gets a free license.
Then why are they calling me?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, I don't know. I think probably this is an issue that needs to be discussed.
Are there any further questions? Roger, Senator Byers, excuse me, has some questions he can ask.
And I'm gonna go back a ways in your testimony. I was just going to hold on to the questions and that way find a highlight of it. In the 9901 binding, you said 3.7 million acres of private land was open to public. And can you tell us where that was with the access and habitat dollars?
Most of that land, the predominant amount of that land is in western Oregon. Some in eastern Oregon. I can't give you the percentage split. A lot of private timber lands are opened up to the public for hunting, either by a cooperative road closure agreement between the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the landowner. Also, there are times when the private timber company wants assurance of some enforcement presence on the land. We contract that with the Department of State Police, and that's how most of those lands are opened up. And most of it, excuse me, most of that land is in western Oregon that is opened up to the public in that way. We do have some land in in the Mid-Columbia region around Heppner. We do have a considerable amount of Boise Cascade land up in northeast Oregon that is open.
Further question, the 7,829 acres of private land that got seed after this fire season, there was over 1 million acres burned in Oregon. Was all the rest public land, or was this just the people who applied, or was only certain areas available for this program with those access and habitat dollars?
The reseeding that of private lands was open to anyone that had wildland fire on their property and needed to have reseeded. A lot of the people who applied for these grants were in and around the fire around Summer Lake itself. But there were several private landowners that received money scattered around Oregon. I don't have all the breakout of that, but we do have all those projects and the grants documented at the office, if you'd like to see those.
My question, I guess, is there. I think there wasn't there more than 7,800 acres of private land burned, so obviously not everybody who had private land burned applied for the money. Is that?
There's a lot more than 7,000 acres of private land that was burned this last year. These are the people who took advantage of the opportunity to apply with the Access and Habitat Board.
Did the rest of the landowners, were they any way notified or told that this program was available for seed, and they chose not to, or just kind of how did that happen?
We put out news releases on it. We also had a public hearing with the commission authorizing authority to me to sign off on these grants rather than going through the typical commission process. Knowing that we needed to get relief back out on the landscape as quickly as possible, the commission allowed me the authority, and within a week's time we could have that turned around and back on the private property. We also had pretty good news coverage. In fact, in Southern Oregon it was quite good. We had three different TV stations reporting on it in the Medford area. So I think it had pretty fair publicity throughout Oregon.
Yes. Do you know, did the rest of the private land, did nothing happen there? Did private landowners just take it on themselves to reseed without accessing funds through these? Or do you have any information to that?
Chair Shields, Senator Beyer, I don't know what happened on the bulk of the private lands. They may have reseeded themselves. They may have had some insurance coverages. It's hard to say.
Okay. Another issue, I don't see it in your comments. I guess you probably can't. I've introduced a bill dealing with the licensing of shellfish harvest. I'd like to make any comments on that. We've seen the bill a few times in the past.
The shellfish license, Chair Shields and Senator Beyer, was an issue that came up from our external budget advisory committee. It was brought up and it was supported by the external budget advisory committee. I told the external budget advisory committee that I was not going to propose a shellfish bill. The agency had proposed one five times since 1987, and it had been soundly rebuked by legislature. I explained to the external budget advisory committee that if they felt that a shellfish license was prudent, that they would need to bring that forward, that I, as the director of the agency, was not going to support it in front of the commission just because of our lack of success in previous sessions. The external budget advisory committee felt pretty strongly that with Washington charging Oregon residents to clam in Washington, and Washington people coming to Oregon on a free tab, so to speak, also the increase in sport harvest of crab and shellfish up and down the coast, they felt pretty strongly that there should be a shellfish license. We also found in our town hall meetings that the public supported a shellfish license. It was quite impressive when we went to Tillamook at our town hall meeting. About 400 people attended that meeting. We lost count at about 300 at the door, and we estimated another 100 people probably were in the auditorium there at the fairgrounds. And almost that whole crowd raised their hand when they were asked if they would support a shellfish license. Of course, they're from the coast, and they clam and crab themselves. So that's where it's at. Knowing that there is an interest in a shellfish license, I did ask my staff to put together a management program under shellfish for shellfish under this concept of a shellfish license. And we had two meetings, and we put together a management program that would be supported by a shellfish license if one should come about. That information is available to anyone who would like to take a look at it.
One of the things that I've been thinking about as I've thought about all this is it's got to do with the fact that I do live in the city. I've probably had about 500 emails from various folks talking about keeping hatcheries open and paying for it themselves through their licenses as they purchase them from you folks. Will your budget and will things like a shellfish license and other things that we might dream up, will that get you where you need to go in terms of sustaining some of the hatcheries, or what's the story there? I'm purely just trying to get my own information gap filled here a little bit.
Well, Chair Shields, I think that's a very appropriate question. I've been asked that by many people myself. The governor's balanced budget for 03-05, which includes the fee increase as you've seen it today, would maintain all the hatcheries and all the current service levels that you now experience from the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Okay. If
money's taken out, then things will have to change, and prioritization will have to be made at that point. Right now, with the current budget, as proposed by the governor, you'll see all hatcheries are open, and everything will be current service level. No enhancements.
Okay.
One
more question.
Get back to the shellfish issue. What's Washington's charges for shellfish license? And do they make a difference to a resident and non-resident?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, I believe... I'd be taking a real stab at this, Senator. It just kind of escapes my mind, but I think they charge residents $7 or $8. And I think non-residents is pretty close to $25. But don't quote me on that. I'll tell you what I'd like to do. Let me get that information, and I'll get it to you. I don't feel comfortable, but that'll put you in the ballpark pretty close, I think. I'll get the hard information for you.
Would you also give me the issue on the total number of people actually buying licenses rather than the two totals, which may add up to way more than this? And do you have a breakdown of, you say that the veterans are supposedly getting free, disabled veterans free licenses?
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, we can get that information to you.
And you don't count the free licenses in with the budgeted licenses? In other words, if information you gave me here of the 3,000 and some odd, or 300,000 that got hunting licenses, and the 689,000 that got fishing licenses, that would not include the free licenses then, too.
Chair Shields, Senator Fisher, I believe that includes all people who hold angling and hunting licenses.
Okay, do you have a breakdown then of how many free licenses you give?
Senator Shields, Senator Fisher, we can get all that information to you. We've got it all.
Yeah.
It's back at the office. Chris Carter's got all that information.
I would appreciate being able to actually ascertain what we're dealing with there.
You could follow.
I have had an extreme amount of phone calls down there from people that are complaining that they just can't afford to hunt anymore because of the license.
Senator Fisher, I'm going to just ask Judith to follow up with Lindsay and get that information for the committee.
Yep. We've got all that. Okay. It's not hard to put together at all.
Do you have any closing comments at all?
No, other than I guess the last information that I provided on what hunting provides to the state of Oregon, what it generates in the way of general fund. I've contended for many, many years that fish and wildlife in Oregon is big business, and I think it's very important that we cautiously ensure that we have that sustained economy in Oregon.
Well, Lindsay, I want to thank you for coming, and I want to remind the audience that if any of you want to respond to either of the two presentations made this morning, or another seven of them that will be made in the next 3 days when we have hearings, please contact Judith, because you'll have a chance for comments that you'd like to make from your organization, if you represent an organization or a committee or whatever, and that'll be on the 31st. So if you make a note of getting a hold of Judith with your desire to have 5 minutes or whatever, what I'm going to do is decide the time of the start of the hearing, depending on the response we get, and we'll start at 8 or 8:30 on that 31st to respond to this or any of the other informational sessions we've had. Lindsay, I want to thank you for coming this morning. And with that, the committee's adjourned.